that did write specifically and mentioned the authorship of these books, as opposed to other, quote, gospels that we're going to talk about in a future class, where there's a name on them, whether it's the gospel of Peter or the gospel of Mary, even the gospel of Judas. You're going to see some of those, but those were not written by those people whose names were on them. They just people assigned those names to them to give them the look of authenticity. But we'll talk about that a little bit later on. Okay, so, as we said, even though these books were divinely inspired, if you're going to convince people who are not religious people, you can't rely on that. And so that's why I'm going through the details in here, so that you can convince them that as historical books, these are much more valid than a lot of other ancient writings. And we compared it to the biographies of Alexander the Great, which were written starting about 400 years after he was written. And the ones that were written 400 years later are considered reliable. The ones that were written 1,000 years after him are not. They include a lot of legendary type material that's not plausible. But the ones that were written 400 years after were universally accepted as being valid. Whereas the biographies of Jesus that were written within about 30 to 60 years from the time that he lived. So they are far more reliable than the others. Okay. We also addressed, were the writers interested in recording accurate information? Because the first thing that you're going to hear from people is they were biased. They were Christian writers. So wasn't it in their best interest to make Jesus sound better than he was? And so what we talked about, we read the introduction to Luke's gospel, where he said that he went to great pains to go through and carefully research and present detailed information on there. And that was typical. They were written in a very responsible way, with information that can be double-checked and fact-checked. It's impossible to verify every single word of the Bible and of the Gospels through other sources, but if there is information we can verify and it turns out to be accurate, that increases our confidence in the reliability of the entire book. If the stuff we can fact check turns out to be wrong, then that immediately calls the whole book into question, which is the case, incidentally, with the Book of Mormon. They have gone through it. They make a lot of archaeologically verifiable claims in the Book of Mormon, absolutely none of which have been verified, even though there have been many efforts to try to do so. Because it relates how Jesus, once he left the Middle East, went and talked to people in America. And there's been absolutely no verification of anything that was in that book. Okay, next question that we addressed last week was, were the writers able to accurately relay information on there? And because the book of Mark was the first one written, the first of the Gospels written, and it was at best written about 30 years after the events. Somewhere around 60 AD is when it would have been written. So we addressed the fact of, okay, could you accurately describe events from three decades before? Yes. Stuck out in your mind. Mm-hmm. And we made a couple of comparisons to, if you were asked to sit there and write down the events of what you were doing on 9/11, you could probably relay those in great detail because it etched it in your mind. It was such a significant event. And we said not only were these highly significant events that meant a lot, they weren't just remembering these from 30 years ago. They had been remembering them all along. They had been preaching them all along. So they weren't allowed to just sit and perhaps get modified over time. They were teaching these events within months or years after the crucifixion. And so whenever you tell your story over and over and over about what happened, you don't lose those details. And the people during that time had a very rich oral history. That is something that they did very well, was relaying information and telling the stories of their ancestors. And they were used to doing that in great levels of detail, as we see in some of the Old Testament writers too. And we said there were rabbis during that time that had memorized the entire Old Testament. Memorized. I can't even imagine such a capability to remember things. But it was something that they practiced. And they had ways to help remember things. Just like if you remember something today, you can kind of set it to music. And if you replace the words of a song you know with the information you're trying to remember, then it helps you remember. And they had techniques like that they would use. Okay? So we addressed the fact that they wanted to provide accurate information because there were people still living who could raise their hand and say, no, it didn't happen that way. I was there. I saw it. You can't claim that Jesus rose from the dead because I saw him buried and that he never moved for the next 10 years. You can walk back there now and go look at the tomb and he's still buried there. So people could have said that if the resurrection didn't really happen and the other events of Jesus' life. So they were verifiable by people who were still alive at the time. Okay, so that caught us up to today where we're going to start. So we're going to start today with, did the writers have the moral character to be trusted to write the gospel? In other words, did they live the events that they were describing here? Did they live their lives as those events were true, as if those events were true? So what do you know about that? How did they live their lives? Mourning. So did the events of Jesus' life have a profound impact on the lives of these writers? Okay. They're willing to die for them. If you made up a story, would you be willing to go to your death claiming that story was true when all it would have taken for you to live is to say, no, I made that up? That's just not the way it works. Of the apostles specifically, John was the only one that died a natural death. All the rest of them were executed, according to history. So not recorded in the Bible, but according to history, he was the only one. And so Jesus' life had a profound impact on these individuals. And it's obvious that they believed what they were writing and what they were preaching during that time. Okay, one question that you might get is, aren't the Gospels inconsistent with each other? Doesn't that make them suspect? If you read a story in one of the Gospels and you read the same events in a different Gospel, sometimes they read a little differently. Does that make them suspect? What are your thoughts? Why doesn't it make them suspect? Either one of you. Go ahead, Ray. You're closer.
Understand how important it is
you remember the question that I asked at the beginning of last week? The question that I asked at the beginning of last week was that if I was able to come up here and stand before you and provide uncontrovertible evidence that Jesus brought, that he was not the Son of God, perhaps that he didn't ever live at all, if I was able to provide absolute proof to your satisfaction, what effect would that have on your life? Would you stop going to church? Would you start going to a synagogue? What effect would it have on your life? And whatever it is, he said, it would be a profound effect on your life. When we teach what I'm talking about right now to people, this is going to have the same profound effect on their life. Because now then it's just the opposite. Now then this person they've dismissed as being a fairy tale that had a messianic complex that thought he was the Son of God, you're able to prove to them that he really was. So you can expect some backlash, just as if I tried to convince you that Jesus was not a real person or wasn't the Son of God. I'm going to drag you to that conclusion kicking and screaming because you don't want to believe it. And the people that you're trying to convince that Jesus did live feel the same way. They're going to grasp at anything to try to say, but. And that's the buts we're addressing right now. And so it's not enough that we believe. We have to convince them that they believe. Okay. Chuck and Russ both.
They recognize details of clothing, for instance, that men don't pay attention to. A guy would just go, I had some dark clothing on, and a woman would say, he had blue jeans and a black nylon t-shirt, or you know, something that specifically tell you what it is. Men are going to pay attention to the car. What did the car look like? The guy would go, I think it was blue. And the guy would go, it was a 1999
Was that in Bellevue, Nebraska? So it happened in two churches. Okay. Yes, Joe. And as we said last week, the Holy Spirit inspired this, but this wasn't a word-by-word dictation. The writers still wrote with their own perspectives, their own vocabulary, their own grammar. And you can see that in the way that the books were written. Even in English, you can detect different tones. Certainly in Greek, you can detect different levels of education. And different perspectives, depending on where it was. But as I said, written by different people who viewed an event from a different perspective, who had a different audience with a different purpose in mind of their writing, yes, they're going to vary. And in fact, probably Russ can verify, if you get three witnesses and they tell the exact same story with the exact same level of detail, that makes them suspect. Because that means they collaborated in advance and they agreed on everything they were going to talk about and they stuck to their story. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Right. And what were they wearing? I don't know. I think they had clothes. So anyway, yeah, it actually makes them more believable that the stories include different details and they didn't have a tape recorder. The words weren't going to be recorded verbatim or anything. And that wasn't important to historical writing standards. There is no such thing as quotation marks in Greek. It's, you tell the events, the primary events. So whether the cock crowed once or three times isn't significant by ancient standards of verifiable veracity. Maybe that's the word I'm grasping for. And so whenever you compare, especially Luke and John, Luke was the journalist. He fact-checked everything and provided all the details, whereas John wrote much later, and he provided more of a commentary on the events. So writing last, he didn't feel the need to tell you every single event in exact chronological order. That was what Luke did. So he felt like he needed to tell the significance of what happened. He wanted to write his gospel to prove that Jesus was the Son of God, whereas Matthew wrote his to prove that Jesus was the Messiah that had been prophesied about. Luke was writing to a Gentile audience, explaining why the gospel was significant to them when they hadn't been Jews. So each of the writers had their own purpose. And so they chose what to relay and in what detail. and what facts to emphasize. Okay, did the gospel writers have an interest, perhaps, in exaggerating the events that happened? They're Christian writers. They're preaching a gospel here. Do you think maybe they would write their textbooks to agree with what it is that they're teaching, kind of like some denominations do today, where they rewrite their Bible to agree with their doctrine? So did they have anything to gain by that? And is there any evidence that that might have happened? There were a lot of events that they recorded that it really would have been a lot more convenient to leave out. Things that weren't particularly flattering, like the apostles bickering among themselves about who was going to be first in the kingdom. If they wanted to leave something out, that would have been a real good story to leave out, because that doesn't paint them in a very positive light. Sometimes it's just an event that raises a lot of questions, like Jesus' baptism. Jesus didn't have any sin, so why was he baptized? We can provide perhaps some speculation on that, but it creates some problems for us perhaps, because certain stories were included that now we have to explain, or things that by our modern sensibilities, don't sound very flattering, like Jesus referring to his mother as woman. You know, if I called my mother woman, I'd probably be slapped to the ground. We read that a little differently than they did. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the next question is, oh, I'm sorry, Chuck, go ahead. True. And also, I don't think in the original Greek it came across the same way that it does in English. But the idea is, if the writers were going to embellish the life of Jesus, they probably would have written it a little differently than they did and left out the unflattering stuff and made it a completely glowing recommendation of not only Jesus but all the apostles' actions and things like that. That would have been a great thing to leave out, because that looks kind of bad, that somebody you handpicked betrayed you. Unless you know that that was the plan all along, that Jesus knew exactly what he was doing. Peter's denial, yeah, that would have been something, especially if you're going to later on call him the first pope. That looks kind of reflects badly on somebody that is supposed to, be infallible. Oh, I'm sorry, Rick. Go ahead. John the Baptist being dead, It is for our benefit. That's right. It's encouraging to know that the apostles weren't perfect.
Oh, yeah.
That they could live that close to Jesus and still misunderstand things and have human frailties and next thing is, as I mentioned earlier, whether archaeology bears out the things that the Bible taught about. Because a lot of times people do question. It's like, you know, the Bible mentions this person, this town, and we've got no record that that ever existed. But they discover new things every day. Just recently, the town of Emmaus that was mentioned in Luke 24. Was found. It was one of those things that people said, we can't even find that this town existed. You know, Luke obviously made a mistake on that. But then they found the town right where it was supposed to be. Although not in the Gospels, it was just some years back, they found the anchors off Paul's ship at Malta. And they said it matched the events in every description. So that's why they were able to be fairly sure those were anchors from the ship that Paul was on. There was an archaeologist that he just dedicated himself to Luke's gospel and in the book of Acts, since there were so many facts that could be checked. And it said he checked 32 countries, 54 cities, and 9 islands and did not find a single mistake that Luke had made. So that's pretty powerful testimony to it. As we said, that can't prove the events of the Bible, but if they disproved the events of the Bible, then that would cause credibility problems for it. But they haven't found anything that contradicted what the Bible says, and many things that do verify it. Okay? Thoughts? The idea is that if Luke was so careful to record these minor details correctly, then don't you think he would have been even more motivated to get the details of doctrine correct and not just the details of the what and the where and the when? John's gospel, it's not just Luke. John's gospel had mentioned the pool at Bethesda and the 5 porticos, and they unearthed it and didn't find the 5 porticos. And so then they were like, aha, you know, he was wrong. And then they kept digging, and over right adjacent to it, they found another pool, and connecting the two were the 5 porticos. So even when you read something that says, oh, we found an issue, generally, that's overturned later when they find the correct information. There were people that questioned whether Nazareth existed. They said, we can't find any record of Nazareth anywhere. There was no mention of it in the Old Testament. Josephus didn't write about it. It wasn't until the 7th century AD that anybody ever wrote about it. But then, finally, researchers found a list in Aramaic, and it showed that some of the priests were relocated from Jerusalem to Nazareth after the fall of Masada, after the Romans took Jerusalem on the uprising. And so they did find a reference to it. What they did find was that it was a town of about 500, so there wasn't really a whole lot of reason to mention it. I mean, that's probably the size of Disputanta where we live, and you see people have lived here all their lives that you say, you live in Disputanta? Where's that? They haven't even heard of it. So, and that's kind of the way it was with Nazareth. It really wasn't that significant, which probably is the reason for the quote. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? You don't expect that. So. Sure.
And we discussed that before, and you've seen the Indiana Jones movie. This is the cup of garbage. So probably the cup was washed and put back on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. All the controversy around the Shroud of Turin. The reason why people start talking about that, and I said, but I have a problem with that because it just looks like the picture that Da Vinci painted. I mean,
yeah.
We don't know that Jesus is going to look anything like that.
Right. Right, yeah, because for one thing, things like that, it would be hard to identify with certainty anyway.
Right.
If you find a cup laying there, how do you know whether it was that cup or not?
Right.
Whereas with places, there's going to be inscriptions and things that will verify what the name of the place is. And sometimes it'll talk about who the ruler was and things like that. Oh, DNA evidence.
That, you know, that movie touched me so much at the time because the guy was looking for that jewel-encrusted cup, and he reaches for his eyes, and the other guy says, he says, this is the cup of a king, this is the cup of a carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
Forgetting that, you know, the guy forgot that he was, came to be an average man.
Yeah, that there was nothing special about that cup. The other thing a lot of historians have questioned is the slaughter of the infants about the time whenever Jesus was born. They said, there's no record of this mass slaughter that happened. Don't you think that would have been significant? And in fact, the only gospel writer that writes about it is Matthew on there. And so people said, you know, there's nothing about it by Josephus or anything else. But once again, Bethlehem was a small town, not much different than Nazareth. And so if you're going to kill the boys under 2 years old in a town that only has 500 people, that's what, three? Five? It's not a mass slaughter in a small town like that. And plus, I mean, Herod was known for killing people, known for killing his own family members. You know, going to a small town and killing three babies wasn't exactly anything that made the news at that time.
And there would have been a mass grave.
No mass graves or anything like that. It's not like killing everybody under two in Jerusalem would have been. You know, that would have been a big deal. Yeah, or like the slaughter of the Jews during the Holocaust. This didn't meet that. In a town of 500, there's not that many babies to begin with, and plus, you're only talking boy babies, and under two, like I said, you can probably count them on one hand. So it's really not this massive slaughter that you imagine at the time. So there's not really a whole lot to make the writings at the time. So it's not really that surprising that you don't read anything about it. So, I've mentioned several times that this was written in the lifetime of the people that were eyewitnesses. Yes, Jeff.
That's true, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So as I said, I mentioned other people that were around to dispute tales. So what do the other contemporary writers of that time talk about? And there were quite a few that we have records of. Some of the Jewish writings have referred to Jesus as a sorcerer, which implies that there were some unexplainable events that happened surrounding his life, things that we would call miracles that, you know, they, if they can't explain them, then they call him a sorcerer. There's not any allegations, really, by those writings that the things in the Bible are untrue. They may have different explanations for them, but they do talk about them. Josephus, as I mentioned earlier, he was a Jewish historian that wrote, he was born 37 AD, I think, and died about 100 AD. He wasn't a particularly popular Jew because he sided with the Romans. And so a lot of the Jews didn't like him. But he wrote a lot about the history of the Jewish race. In fact, he's got a whole series of books about those. And he wrote a section about Jesus. Now, the text is kind of suspect, I will tell you, because in the text that he wrote, there are some phrases in there that sound out of context and they don't match the writing style of anything else. So they were probably added later by Christian writers. And so in the interest of full disclosure, I will tell you that. But luckily, they found a different text of it that was written in Arabic that was an independent verification. And it did leave out some of those key phrases and everything. But it still talks about Jesus. So if we take out the embellishments that were probably later added, what he wrote was, at this time there was a wise man who was called Jesus. His conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. And many people from among the Jews and other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him, to be crucified and to die. And those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion and that he was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah according whom the prophets have recounted wonders. And that's from Jewish Antiquities, you know, volume 18, pages 63 to 64. And so taking out, there were some specific references that said he was the Christ and, you know, things like that, and that he was the Son of God. And so discounting those that probably weren't part of what Josephus actually wrote, it still provides some pretty good verification of the events of the Bible, and pretty much shoots down any idea that Jesus was not a real historical character, that he was made up. Tacitus was a Roman historian that wrote about 115 AD, and he talked about the fires in Rome whenever Nero blamed the Christians. It says, he wrote, "But all human efforts, all the lavish gifts of the emperor, and the propitiations of the gods did not banish the sinister belief that the conflagration was the result of an order. Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Then upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind." Not a particularly flattering description of Christians, but once again, it verifies the fact that Jesus was a real historical person and that he was crucified by Pilate. So this is just additional things talked about it. There are other writers too. Pliny the Younger talked about Christians meeting on a fixed day to honor a god by an oath. A writer called Thallus talks about a period of darkness in 33 AD about noon that was visible in Rome and in Athens and around the Mediterranean area where the stars appeared in the heavens, and they mentioned an earthquake during that time. So there are other writers here. And so the summary of all this is that we can be very sure of what the gospel writers wrote about. They had no motivation to lie. And in fact, if they were going to, they left in a lot of material that they probably would have purged if they were going to embellish this tale. That it was written in the lifetime of people who could have disputed this, and there was no such dispute of these events on here. So they had every motivation to get it right and no motivation to get it wrong, and they went to their deaths, very violent deaths, verifying that what they wrote about was true and that the events that were in the Gospels were true. So this is some pretty powerful testimony. So we can be absolutely confident that the writings were divinely inspired and that they accurately recorded those events. But even if you don't believe they were inspired, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that what they wrote was true. Yes, Mark. That is correct. He was a contemporary of Paul. So Paul is the one that he would have talked about Jesus, and would have been the one that told him a lot. But he also did a lot of investigating on his own, as he relays at the beginning of the book of Luke, where it says that he carefully researched and to make sure that everything that he laid out was true and correct. So he was not an apostle, but he wasn't somebody who accompanied Paul on some of his missionary journeys. Okay.